self-compassion won't make you lose your edge. It'll actually make you perform in the way that your wisest self would want to perform. But the half-truth of it is that you might just lose your edge in areas that are not important to you. When we're more self-compassionate, we start to realize, oh, I'm pushing myself really hard in this area that actually isn't aligned with my values or who I want to be in the world, and I'm just doing it because of these rules or expectations or shoulds or whatever it is. And when you start to practice self-compassion, then you may choose not to push yourself so hard.
That was Diana Hill, and this is Mentally Flexible. Welcome to Mentally Flexible, where we have meaningful conversations to help you build mental flexibility. I'm Tom Parks. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and in each episode, I'll be talking to people who inspire me most on topics related to psychology, mental health, and creativity. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll better understand yourself, others, and the world around you. Thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. My guest today is Dr. Diana Hill. Diana is a clinical psychologist, international trainer, and sought-out speaker on acceptance and commitment therapy and compassion, host of the Wise Effort podcast, and author of the Self-Compassion Daily Journal, the ACT Daily Journal, and the upcoming book, Wise Effort. Diana works with organizations and individuals to develop psychological flexibility so that they can grow fulfilling and impactful lives. Some of the topics we explore in this episode include the value of stretching outside of our comfort zones, ways to help carry the heaviness in life, fears related to being more self-compassionate, Diana's process of releasing a new book while also navigating personal challenges, how we can minimize our difficulties and struggle to ask for help, and dealing with the pain of past regrets and needing to forgive ourselves. It was so nice to connect with Diana again in this space. We touched on so many important topics here that I hope you'll be able to relate to in your own lives or in the work that you do. I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy of her new self-compassion workbook, and it's really great. Definitely recommend checking it out. I'll leave a link to the book in the show notes, and in there you can also see some ways to help support the podcast. And as always, thank you for being here and enjoy this conversation with Dr. Diana Hill. Preparation. Well, it's not even preparation because I like your podcast. I was listening to one of the most recent ones when you switched over into Wise Effort. It's really well done, and I love what you're doing there with that change you made.
Good. Yeah. We're allowed to change. We have to. But yeah, it's scary. So thank you. Thank you. I love that feedback, and I'll take more, anything you got. Because, you know, as you know, in podcasting, we don't get much all the time. You know, it's just sort of you're talking to one, no one feels like sometimes. Yeah.
What motivated that changeover? I know you described it a bit in the episode, but to share more.
What motivated the change for me was I was getting a little bit stuck in the sameness. So I started Your Life in Process because I was ready to kind of go out on my own. We get this courage, right? I want to do something new. I want to go out on my own. I wanted to have freedom to explore and create. And then guess what I found myself doing? The same thing that I always do. I just went back into my old comfy rut. And for me, a comfy rut is always thinking that other people have better ideas than I do, and interviewing folks, and which I love. I've grown so much from all the interviews that I've done. I've grown so much. And there's also a part of me that's like, I want to stop collecting so much information because I'm in information overload, and I want to just practice. I just want to practice. I want to explore what this actually looks like, not just theorize about it, but actually do it in a real play and see what happens in there when we explore these practices. And then I still do want those interviews and that wisdom because I want to keep growing. But my comfort zone is always interviewing other people. Not that you can relate.
No, I relate to that so much. Yeah, there's a lot there. I just got asked for the first time before you asked me the other day. I got asked for the first time to be on a podcast, and the imposterism that showed up inside of me that honestly almost hooked me to saying no, that I didn't have anything to offer to be on that side. And the only thing I had to offer was asking good questions or holding space. I really had to pause and use a lot of the skills that you talk about in your new book, because yeah, that stuff almost felt so true and so real that I didn't have anything else to offer. And the comfort zone, falling back into the comfort zone is so alluring.
Yeah, it's so alluring. And then we just, whatever that comfort zone is, maybe for your listeners, it's not that. I mean, we're sort of a niche little connection here around being podcasters, but maybe the comfort zone is at work. You have an area that you just stay in because you know how to do it, but there's another little part of you that wonders, wow, what would it be like if I stretched? Or you have a little, just a little yearning to do something different. And what I have found is that whenever I make that move, it's excruciating in the lead up to it, of a lot of self-criticism, a lot of self-judgment, a lot of questioning of myself. I had that certainly when I did the first podcast move and then this podcast move, same deal. I thought I'd evolved past it, but no, it's the same. But what has been different for me now is I can expect it. Like, this is what change feels like. This is what stretching feels like. As a yoga teacher, I know that in the body, like, this is what stretching feels like. It's uncomfortable, but it's not harming you. Mm-hmm. Right. And you know when it is harmful. Like, you'll know when you're moving into a stretch where you're gonna throw your back out or something like that. The same is true for stretching out of our comfort zone. So I encourage you to go on that podcast, and I'm encouraging you to come on mine as well. I'd love to do a real play with you.
Yeah.
But no pressure.
Yeah. No, that stretching that leaves us feeling so vulnerable, but that vulnerability is both where there is potential to be hurt, but also potential for growth. And it's an easy place to just avoid or trick yourself into thinking there's good reasons why not to go there, or even not even consider going there at all. But it is a little exposing.
Yeah. When we come against our own demons in the mirror, right? Whether you said the imposterism or the just these old voices that we've had around for a long time, and they come up and they kind of know our spots to scare us the most. And so I've experienced that in so many different ways in my life, in my own recovery, in my career, in parenting. The demons that I've had seem now are familiar to me, so I can spot them, and I know I need to get to know them, be with them. And then usually, at least for me, I get to the other side of that comfort zone, and then I fall back in. So it's this, I actually, I see a lot of our experience, or at least growth with my clients and with myself, is that we get into the space of harmony, and we really like it, and we want to stay there forever in harmony. And then either unchosen harmony comes, or we know that we need to move into disharmony in some way, like we need to grow. And so we move into disharmony, but in that disharmony space, if we can stay there long enough, we'll move into a new harmony. And it's not like you go back, it's that you go somewhere different. So with the Wise Effort podcast, or with books I'm writing, or with parenting, it's just this creating of new harmony, but it's not without disharmony. Mm. That's part of the cycle. And then you get back into harmony again, and then you move to disharmony, and it's continued evolution. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There is this idea that eventually you'll get to some stable place where everything's figured out and we'll be the version of ourselves that we're meant to be. And then I don't know what we expect to happen. Everything, the heavens to open up and life just is good forever. But yeah, it's just no matter how much we grow or how wise we get, there's always more and wiser and things outside of our control and challenging situations. And so it's really this just ongoing process of coming in and out of balance more gracefully.
Mm-hmm. So you were having a bad week.
Yeah.
Careful what you tell me off the air. It's a perfect avenue, rich for compassion.
Yeah.
We don't have to talk about specifically what, but I'm just curious, like, when you have a bad week, when you move into that disharmony, what happens for you, and how do you navigate it, and where does compassion or self-compassion come in that whole picture of things?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I'm happy to talk about it. It's interesting how much of this, for me at this point, is intrinsic and intuitive, and so then having to put language to something that feels fully understood inside can be difficult. And maybe that's what's so good about people I admire that communicate so well, that flow of what's happening inside and getting it externally is, it seems so seamless, but it can be difficult, right? It takes practice. From a high level, I think just learning how to slow down and open up to whatever's there for me in the present moment and hold it with some compassion and kindness and openness and not just react to it so much or see it automatically as a problem. I think when I was younger, waking up and it being a bad day or like having a bad night's sleep or feeling something, there was so much reactivity in that automatically from seeing it as a problem that you needed to solve or figure out how to get away from. And even just the switch to be able to be with it and not let getting away from it be in the driver's seat of my day is a huge switch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's a difference between label, and I labeled it as bad. I don't know if you used the label bad when you shared with me.
It said heavy, I think.
Heavy. Yeah. So, you know, I took that heavy and I turned it bad. Mm-hmm. And that's what our mind does, right? Because a heavy week has a different feel to it. It's like, I'm carrying some extra loads this week. And if I'm carrying some extra loads, then how am I going to treat myself? Like, if you're, my son's getting ready for a backpacking trip. It's his mm-hmm. first backpacking trip. And it's been super fun connecting with him because I did a lot of backpacking as a kid. And we're talking about loads. Like, where are you carrying it? Are you carrying it on your hips? Or are you carrying it on your shoulders? And how different when you shift the load to your hips from your shoulders, that pack feels. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, my dad used to teach me something called the rest step. When we would hike. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, every single step has a rest. Every single step has a rest in it. Even if you're going uphill and you're climbing a rock, you take that, and people can practice this at home when they walk the stairs. You step your weight into one foot and there's a moment where you're resting. Mm-hmm. And one foot is stabilizing. And then you step your, and you get the momentum to go on the other, you know, the other foot. And when we think about heavy loads or a heavy week, you know, we think a hill is bad. Or carrying a load on our back is bad, but some of these are chosen loads. You know, a lot of the heaviness of our week comes from things that we've chosen. Like mm-hmm. I've chosen this career where I talk with people or I'm on a, you know, and I've chosen this marriage or I've chosen to be a dog owner that's gotten sick or whatever the chosen pain, you know, the chosen load that you've carried, that you're going to carry. But I think of self-compassion is how do you carry that load? You know, can you move it to your hips a little bit more to give your shoulders a break? And can you find a rest even when it's so heavy? And that's just sort of my practice of it is, but it's good to notice how we turn it bad, how I turned it bad.
Yeah.
So quickly.
Well, that's just the conditioned way of thinking and talking. And it can have implications depending on how much we let the bad equal problem to be solved. But it can happen quickly. Another part is just having this deeper, I don't know, faith, I never really use that word, but trust almost, like from when I zoom out, that just understanding that this really is a part of being human, savoring the good and having to be present with the challenging parts of life, they all go together. And so when I'm in a chapter of life, a week or a day like this, it's just, yeah, seeing it as part of the process and not having to even tell myself that or intellectualize it. It's like there's this deeper place in my being that really understands that. It's like when you're watching a movie and it has the different phases and then there's the suspense and the release of it and everything's good and then everything's bad again. You understand how that's all built in. That's sort of how I see life too on this deeper level.
Mm-hmm. So this morning I have a morning practice where I usually do a meditation. I do a little journaling. And because I had this journal come out today, I went and I have a bunch of journals in my shelf and I pulled all of my journals down. And the way that I journal is so inconsistent with, it's like whatever journal's around, I'll add to. So these journals will have like years, like one journal will start in 2021 and then it'll go to 2023. And so I pulled out this one journal just to look at it and to kind of leaf through. And I tend to write on these like major life event days, right? So like a book is coming out or a baby's being born or a kid's going on their first kindergarten, you know, field trip and I'm scared, or I got in a fight with my mom. Like those, oftentimes that's when we journal, right? And I was looking through it, and it was, I actually highlighted some stuff and wrote some stuff in the back because I thought it would be helpful as a thinking about talking with you and as these themes that show up and talk about loads, that we all have our themes. And if you actually start to look at the themes, like if you could like put your journals in ChatGPT and say, give me the top three themes. These were the ones for me. So I wrote them down because I just wrote down these quotes. And this is from like years. So I wrote, I feel like I'm losing track of myself. Mm. Or maybe I've already lost her. The running is endless. It feels so useless. I can't work my way out of this. I'm keeping a pace that is unsustainable. I want to cancel it all.
Mm-hmm.
This was my life. I've been saying this for years. And you know, where self-compassion comes in is like, wow, okay, would you actually, like if you actually listen to the themes of your life, mm-hmm. that's just my theme, is the overdoing theme. But other people have other themes. If you actually were to respond to that person over the course of your life that's saying the same thing for years, how would you respond? How would you help them out? How would you carry their loads differently? And, you know, it just made me think about exactly what you're saying. Like, can you sit in the center of it all, even if some of it's all kind of the same? Loads that keep coming back.
Mm, well, thanks for sharing that. It is interesting and useful to be able to recognize the ongoing nature of a lot of our inner challenges.
Mm-hmm. Is there a theme to yours for this week? An ongoing nature? Like if there was like a ChatGPT summary?
I think that a lot of my challenges also center around taking on too much or feeling like I have too much on my plate. And a lot of it being chosen too. But it's also, I don't know, it's so hard. It's like I have two parts of me sometimes because that I just make space for, that I move in and out of understanding why everything is the way that it is and being happy to take it on. And then other times where that other voice and feelings come in. And it's just like, I don't know, I really just am deeper and deeper in my awareness, just watching the interplay between these two things and then trying to make more conscious actions through the integrated wisdom of that to find balance in my life and just to be a little bit more intentional. But yeah, I have that. And it's interesting. You have journals. I have songs. So I have probably hundreds of songs that I've written in my life. And it's cool to go back and listen to stuff I wrote from when I was 15, 18, 20, 21, you know, up till now, and I'm 31, and I can pull themes from that too. And it's these little portals back into where I was when I was younger. And I find that as a really useful way to be compassionate towards my younger self, because there is a lot of authenticity and realness, albeit maybe cringy at times if I was ever to share with somebody else. But I can really touch pain and sincerity in songs that I wrote when I was much younger. And I find that really useful.
It's so sweet, isn't it? To hear even in hearing the cringiness, the vulnerability of it, you know, it's if you have enough distance from it, you know, if it's not last week that you're listening to or last week's journal writing, but if you have enough distance from it, you can develop that compassionate sense of, I can see that you were going through something and you were working your way through it. And now I'm sitting in a spot of this wisdom now that I can look at you then. There's a really beautiful visualization that I'll often do with clients. And I basically have them sit on the X marks the spot of their life as it is right now and let them sort of sit in the problem that feels so heavy. And then creating this timeline that goes out to the left, which is to their younger self, and goes out from before they were born, because the timeline of our struggles is in our epigenetics, it's in our ancestors, right? It's in way before we're born. And then the timeline goes out to the right, to when they're going to get old and they're going to die, and beyond when they're dead, because even beyond when we're dead, the imprint of our lives remains on this planet and is continued on forever, the continuation. And so you sit in the timeline of your life and you kind of get into your headiness of your problem. And then you walk back and you find a younger version of you when they were in their headiness of their problem.
Mm.
And you meet them and you sit down with them and you see them and you look at them and you say, I know, because only you know what it was like to be that, you know, that Thomas writing that song.
Yeah.
And then you give them, you know, you give them a little love, give them a little advice, and then you grab their hand, you pull them up, put them right next to you on one side. And then you look over to the right and you see like your older version of you. This is the classic act, compassion. See the older version of you, but the older version of you, like totally flesh them out. Like, what are they wearing? What is their hair like? How are they, you know, how is their face seasoned? What do they know that you don't know? Then you let them come and they let them look at you in the eyes and say, I know, because only they know. And they give you some advice. And then you sit them both down. And I'll often do this like in workshops, right? So then you have your younger version, you have your older version saddled up right next to you. And here you are in the complete wisdom of you. Because yes, there's you in this moment that feels like it's all overwhelming. But there's a wise version of there of you that's always been there. I mean, I believe that we're born. I mean, I remember holding my babies, and there was so, like, in some ways, they were the most wise because their narrative hadn't gotten, you know, off to the races yet. They were so embodied, right? So connected. And so then you get all this wisdom, and then I have people write it down. And you can keep it for yourself, but if I'm doing it in a workshop, I have them pass it around to other people. You know, just get up and pass all the wisdom that we share. When you're stuck in your problem or you're stuck in your head, it's hard to access that. But I see a lot, I mean, I think a lot of our work as a therapist is just to help people access what's already there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's so much language there, or there's so much avoidance there, or there's so much attachment there that it's hard to access.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. I briefly worked on a research project where MAPS was using MDMA to treat PTSD. I wasn't a clinician yet. I was in grad school, so I had a smaller role briefly. But I liked the way that they talked about that treatment, where it was all centered around that the drugs were a way to help somebody reconnect with their own inner wisdom. And the role as the clinician was just to help them have a space to do that. And even though what we're doing in psychotherapy doesn't involve, you know, taking MDMA, that's something that always sits with me, that it takes some of the pressure off of how hard we have to work to make something happen, when really, really we're just inviting somebody to clear space to connect with something that's already in there.
Yeah. And you could think about that, and as a psychotherapist, you could think about that as a podcaster, like how much we over-prepare.
Yeah.
And really, if you just create the right space, they'll step in.
Yes.
And they'll co-create something with you. Or if you are a parent, or if you're a leader at work, or you're a sibling, or you're a partner, like what is it that you could do that could create the most nurturing environment possible for somebody's wisest self? To show up.
Yes.
And then if their wisest self shows up, then you can also, you know, bring your wisest self to the table. We think it's all our responsibility. You know, so many of my clients talk about just feeling the heaviness of responsibility, whether it's they're a healthcare provider or a therapist or you know, a child taking care of their aging parent. And a lot of, I think, I've taken this sort of deep dive into wisdom because of the Wise Effort podcast and this book that I'm working on Wise Effort. And a lot of the, you know, what's been written on wisdom in terms of from a contemplative practice perspective, an indigenous practice perspective, or a psychological perspective practice, is that wisdom is much more than than in our heads or in ourselves, right? So there's wisdom of the heart, there's wisdom of the body, there's wisdom of our relationship, our relationship wisdom. There's wisdom of our ancestors. There's the sort of wit, cleverness kind of wisdom, like how to solve a problem kind of wisdom. There's wisdom of nature. It's much more collective than that. And so if we think that it's our job to, like, you know, pull something out of someone, then we're actually not being very wise at all.
Yeah, we are sort of working against the current of how the universe is structured.
Yeah.
Mm. When you were talking about that exercise of connecting with your past self and future self, it made me think, I would love to do that right now. And I'd be able to connect with that if I was in therapy with you and we were together. I was at a workshop and it made me think about a younger version of myself would have had such a hard time opening up to something that sincere, vulnerable. And, you know, I could picture clients on my caseload that might have a hard time with that. What do you think it is that makes it hard for people to be compassionate towards themselves or really lean in to something that sincere?
Well, we have lots of fears of compassion towards ourselves. I've had my own fears and I continue to have my own fears. Like it'll show up like if I'm really honest here or vulnerable here or kind to myself, some of the common fears are things like we'll lose our edge. We have fears that if we're compassionate, we'll be selfish. And we have, you know, sort of this fear that compassion is kind of hokey, especially with the younger clients. It's like, it's kind of cheesy. And I would say all three of those are half truths. There's a half truth to all three of them, actually. With compassion losing your edge, there's a tremendous amount of research that shows that self-compassion in particular improves your performance. So we know this from everything from Berkeley students who they purposely make them fail on a test. If they have a self-compassion intervention, they study harder for the next test, right? Mm-hmm. To people that are restrictive eaters who eat a donut in a research study, if they practice self-compassion, they're actually less likely to eat the Skittles and the Reese's and the York peppermint patties that are in the research room. Right? So we know that actually compassion, self-compassion won't make you lose your edge. It'll actually make you perform in the way that your wisest self would want to perform. But the half-truth of it is that you might just lose your edge in areas that are not important to you.
Mm.
That when we're more self-compassionate, we start to realize, oh, I'm pushing myself really hard in this area that actually isn't aligned with my values or who I want to be in the world. And I'm just doing it because of these rules or expectations or shoulds or whatever it is. And when you start to practice self-compassion, then you may choose not to push yourself so hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe, you know, I'm the type of person that like, if you put me on a treadmill, I'm putting on level 10, like that's my automatic. Where's 10 and a half? This thing doesn't go steep enough or fast enough for me. Because that's my training. Like that is my automatic always. Push 100%, crash. Push, crash, push, crash. Like, and so practicing self-compassion is actually, what level is the right level for me right now, given my day? And sometimes that's a level 10. Like I want to go all out. I want to go hard. I want to feel that energy of really like growing and pushing. And then sometimes it's, I want to walk today. And self-compassion helps you learn to trust yourself that it doesn't mean you're always going to walk. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you're always going to go level 10. You're actually going to listen to what you need and care for yourself. So you may lose your edge. And then the other half truth of it being selfish is that there's some newer research out that Joseph Sirochi did around self-compassion and there's research on self-compassion and selfishness, and then there's research on the benefits of self-compassion. That self-compassion does not benefit everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that it doesn't benefit were, in particular, people who don't see compassion as a harmonious flow.
Mm.
The idea of a harmonious flow is when I'm compassionate to myself, then I can better show up for Thomas.
Mm.
And when Thomas is compassionate for himself, then he can better show up for his dog. Mm. Right? That it's harmonious. And there's also some research that men who were, who practiced self-compassion, but that were low on conscientiousness, the personality variable of conscientiousness actually showed more selfishness. So it's not like, okay, and this is where we have to start to look at like how you're using these tools. It's not like mindfulness is good for everyone. Self-compassion is good for everyone. We actually have to look at the how and why.
Yes.
So sometimes self-compassion can be selfish, and that's why we have to remember. And when I wrote the Self-Compassion Daily Journal, I was really intentional about this is a flow, and how are you gonna send this out so that it's not just about you, right?
Totally.
And then the third part about third half truth of self-compassion being hokey is that it just might be a little bit hokey. So. You can choose a different word. I mean, I like recoil. It's like some people recoil. I recoil from the self-love thing. Some people love the self-love thing. Like, what word do you want to use? Sort of like the word for acceptance, some clients recoil from. So don't use acceptance. Use openness. If you don't want to use self-compassion, you know, I got in this huge debate with Dan Siegel about self-compassion. Self-compassion is the construct with which has been researched, like the word that they put into research studies, right? So they're consistent with it. Dan was like, I am so against the word self-compassion because it's talking about the self in a way that the self is this inner self. And the self is so much more than that. He's all about interconnected. So if you want to use a different word for self-compassion, do another word, like being kind to myself or being encouraged or my best motivational coach ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Give yourself warmth or whatever language. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, totally. Yeah. The ability to, as therapists, to be able to move with what a client's saying and the context of their life and not be so stuck on things needing to look a certain way or be said a certain way is an important skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What resonates? You can feel it in your body. What resonates?
Yeah. Yeah. And ultimately it's helping us. It's not really about any word. It's about an state of being or a inner behavior or a way we move into the world. Like it's much deeper than the word. So that's just a doorway into something richer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We kind of have been talking around it, but maybe let's really just acknowledge and give you some congratulations on your book coming out today, right? This is March 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's that process been like for you?
It's a really hard time for a book to come out for me.
It's
the truth. my husband's been going through a tremendous amount of health issues that have required us. I live in Santa Barbara, which is 2.5 hours, 3 hours from Los Angeles, UCLA, one of the best medical universities out there. And so we're going back and forth to UCLA once, twice a week.
Wow.
He's having his fourth surgery next Thursday. And here I am, like, supposed to be, and I am, I'm doing it, like, pushing and promoting this book. And what I really want to be doing is just, like, hiding out, hunkering down, not getting dressed, hanging out with my husband. And so it's been a rough time of things in my life. And my husband's also my partner in all things. So it's also been a real readjustment to figuring out how to do a lot of things that when you've been with somebody for 25 years, you start to like become one organism where like he has a left hand that does these things and I have a right hand that does these things and we work together, the left hand and the right hand. But what happens when the left hand gets sick? The right hand has to figure out all sorts of things the right hand has no clue on. So that's been a bit challenging. And yeah, so that's the truth of it, Thomas. A whole lot of self-compassion needed. And it feels some of it also like in the promotional world of Instagram and promotion and all those things that we need to do for a business, which I think people can relate to no matter what business you're in. If you know, whatever it is you're in, a lot of people feel like they need to do this type of promotion that it feels like a lot of work that may not have the impact when I could be putting my energy in really important places that have a really important impact, which is my family.
Well, talk about a heavy chapter there you go. Of life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know how to phrase it. Like, why do you keep doing this then? This part, like,
there's lots of whys. One why is I have to remember the intention behind the work, right? So the intention around promoting and spreading help to people. I mean, that's why I became a psychologist, and I see it as a short term. This is sort of like a short term push to make that happen. Another why, which is not as I guess it's connected to a value of mine, which is sort of responsibility and commitments, right? So I keep commitments, and I made a commitment for this, my publisher, with all sorts of people to do sort of the minimum, and I'm doing a different job than I did with my first book. I'm doing a different job now. I've definitely adjusted, and we've adjusted our lives in lots of ways. There is something about, I think it was Brad Stolberg I was talking to about this, where when you have lots of different domains with different values in them, they can bring you relief. On a really hard day, when I come down and see a client and talk about their really hard day, it brings me relief. When I do a podcast with you, and I've been more intentional of who am I doing these things with? Like, I want to do them with people. I reached out to you on this. Like, I want to do them with people that are aligned with this sort of compassionate values, that it feels good to be in their presence. Mm-hmm. And so I've had actually this boost of support from a lot of friends and in different ways. So that's maybe another why, is it actually feeds back to me in an unexpected way.
Mm, yeah, I totally hear that. It sounds like it's one thing it's doing is helping you be more intentional with the spaces you put yourself in and how you're using your time. Mm-hmm. What have you found to be the most important ways you use self-compassion during this difficult time of your life?
One way goes back to that timeline exercise, and maybe what also told me to pull out my journals, because March 1st is also the anniversary of my baby's death. Not to drop too many heavy things on you in one episode, but I'm in a heavy place. So it's also the anniversary, March 1st is the anniversary of my baby's death, that I had a stillborn. And so I was going back actually to try and find, where is that journal entry in all my mismanaged, disorganized journals that I write everything in. And so one thing that actually really helps me is reminding myself that I've been through hard stuff before. Like, that zoom out perspective process from ACT is so helpful to me, because when I'm having a hard time, I have a tendency, like many of us do, think this is never going to end. I can't handle it. I'm never going to get out of it. Things are just going to keep, getting worse and worse and worse. But what we don't realize is the wave comes up and the wave comes back down. So that's helpful for me to have that reminder of the self-compassionate statement of, you've been through hard things before. You've done this before. When my son goes up to bat at baseball, there's always people on the sidelines, all the parents giving coaching advice that should not be giving coaching advice. It's often against what the coach is saying, and you're my gosh, these parents, right? And they're giving all this coaching advice. And so I had to figure out, okay, what's my line going to be when a kid goes up to bat that I can just say to the kids that go up? And I, over the years, I have this line that when a kid goes up to bat, I say, you know what to do. You've done this before. Because no matter what batting situation you are in, you've done this before. You did it in practice. You did it in the batting cages. It feels different right now because you're on the stage or whatever, but you've done it before. So I've been practicing that with myself of I don't know what to do in terms of having my husband's going through stuff. I also know that this is going to be a wave, and I'm going to go through my stuff in the future, and he's going to be there for me. But I also know what to do because I've done this before. I've done a lot of hard things before. And that is the encouragement, the strength, because for me, compassion isn't it's warmth for sure, but it's also, can you align your spine in a way that helps you open your heart, zipper up the back of the spine and hold your head over your neck in alignment, so it's not so much heavy of a load, and let your shoulders drop and let your belly and your exhale go. And that's a lot of meditation practice, right? We prepare our bodies in meditation so that we can practice. And our bodies, if we do a lot of meditation, your body just will be I've done this before, so I know how to land. That's my very windabout answer to that question.
No, I really appreciate that. It's interesting, as you, once you talked about some of these challenges you're going through, I don't buy into these thoughts, but I notice I noticed thoughts pop up like, oh, why I shouldn't have said anything. Like, oh, I'm not going through a hard week if this is what Diana's going through. And I know you're not, I know you don't think that. And I actually don't buy into that thought, but it maybe just draws attention to a challenge that we can go through and clients can go through where we sort of evaluate our own suffering in comparison to other people's and how that prevents us from honoring where we're at.
Yeah, I do the same thing because I say things like, oh, well, you know, the first surgery went was hard, but the second surgery went so well. So then maybe I shouldn't be complaining that this is hard. Mm-hmm. And actually my husband is like, I really do think it's lucky. I just got super lucky. We met in yoga class. I was a college student. He was a math teacher. And we would go to the same yoga class, but I never knew he was there. And then one day the teacher, this was like before people went to yoga class to meet people. Let's just start there. There was no Lululemon happening. It was like sweatpants, right? And so this yoga teacher put us together in partner yoga. Like, you two seem like a good fit. And I just like struck it, like struck gold with this guy. Who knew? I was a complete disaster, like complete disaster. And here's this like math teacher. I mean, he's just like so solid, super solid, such a solid container for me. And so, you know, I'll say things like that. I'm like, well, I shouldn't be complaining so much, or this shouldn't be so hard because look at this husband I have who's like going through all this stuff and he's handling it better than I am, you know? So these are all the things that we say. I should be feeling this isn't bad enough. And then what that ends up doing to us is when we have that narrative is then we actually don't do the practice of asking for support, which is a self-compassion practice, like saying, hey, I need some help here, because we minimize our problems or they're not bad enough, or my friend's going through a divorce, so I better not bother her. I just won't text her for like a few weeks while she's going through the divorce because I don't want to tell her that like I'm having a hard time with my breakup or whatever. Mm. Or my, you know, and so that actually disconnects us rather than connecting around we all suffer. And one person's suffering is not worse than another's because it's different, right? Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really struggle with that minimizing and asking for help, feeling worthy of asking for help, and just like so bizarre on one level because I'm giving myself for 25 to 30 hours a week with other people and to buy into an idea that I don't deserve 30 minutes of that with someone or whatever the scenario is. It's an interesting thing to just shine a light on.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't do that. I do that as well as I have a hard time. This is a newer behavior for me of like friendship and asking for help. And then sometimes when I get the help, I feel guilty, mm. You know? Like I have all these friends that are showing up for me. Like even with you, Thomas, I'm like, I kind of feel guilty that I asked you to help me make this 1 minute video to promote this book. I felt guilty. Like this is my other patterning. And part of the shift is also remembering, oh, wait a minute. I do this for a living. I help people and how good it makes me feel to be of help. So I'm giving someone else the gift of being helpful. Yeah. Right now, like that you're actually giving them, because it's our natural tendency as humans to help each other. This is how we survived, right? Mm. So that there's a little bit of a mental shift there in that flow of compassion. And it's very common for therapists or teachers or healthcare providers or parents for that to be the difficult one, the receiving help, receiving help from others.
It's so true because I was excited and I remember coming home and telling my wife how excited I was that someone who wrote a book, well, she knows you because you've been on and she listens, and that Diana asked me to help her in this way. It felt like such a beautiful thing that you even thought of me, and I was so excited to do it. It was like a big moment for me. And it's just funny if we could like zoom into our minds how contrasted those were in that moment and vice versa, how that is the next time I have to ask someone for help. I don't know. We have such like a unfair negative bias towards ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other kind of tricky patterning that comes around that, and I see this a lot with my clients, as well as with myself, is that we don't ask for help, but then we're expecting people to see that we're struggling and to be helpful.
Yeah.
Like, haven't you noticed that I have not texted you back for 3 weeks? Isn't that on your radar that I have not texted you? You should be concerned that I'm not texting you. Right? We see this all the time with our clients, this expectation for, you know, people to know that we're struggling. And they have no, I mean, people are busy. They're going about their lives like, yeah, no, I didn't really, you know, it was kind of off my radar. And actually, are you familiar with Joan Halifax?
She's a... Yeah. She does stuff Joan like Halifax. In the Ram Dass umbrella.
She's in the Ram Dass umbrella. She's like this like pretty well-known Buddhist teacher. And I was on retreat with her a couple of weeks ago. And she was like, you know, what I really think is the most helpful thing is to recognize... I was thinking she was going to say some like Buddhist thing. She was like, to recognize the drama triangle. I was like... like the drama triangle. This is like bringing me back to my psychodynamic training here, which is very slim. Like I had like a tiny little bit, but the drama triangle is one in which you have a victim, a rescuer, and a persecutor. Did you ever learn about this drama triangle?
No, say more.
Okay. So you have a victim. I'm like Roshi Joan Halifax is talking about the drama triangle. So you have a victim, which is that tendency to be like, I'm stuck in my problem, but I'm not going to ask for help. Which can, it can start there, but that can actually turn into victimhood. At least for me, it can turn into victimhood where like, mm-hmm. doesn't anyone even notice that I clean the kitchen? Mm-hmm. You know, versus saying, hey guys, when I clean the kitchen, I really could use some appreciation because that's like how mama gets it. Like it feels good to me for you to appreciate it. So we can get into victim. And then what we can do is we're in victim. We pull upon rescuers, like people to rescue us. You know, or we can turn into persecutors where we blame people for not rescuing us. And we all kind of float around this drama triangle. So we may be, if you're a victim, you may be drawn to people that will rescue you. If you're a rescuer, you're drawn to victims. If you're a persecutor, you may like victims as well. So the drama triangle. But I think that that's where, at least for me, there's like this close cousin of not asking for help. And I see it with clients too, is stepping into victim and then stepping into persecutor, getting mad.
Yes.
Getting mad.
Totally. Yeah. And all of us have all three of those within us to some degree, and in relationship, being aware of those three parts inside of you and your partner being aware of those, and that just being out on the table as part of what being human is, and being aware of how to not fall into those traps can be so helpful instead of like trying to fight against having any of that in you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, we have all of them. I mean, we also have rescue ourselves that will rescue people, and then get really angry at them. You know? So it's...
When they're not rescued in the way you want them to be.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's the flow of compassion, of being able to offer compassion to ourselves, or being able to offer compassion to another person, or being able to receive compassion, I think is where it's at. That's Paul Gilbert's stuff. But I really do see it as a flow. And it's not just about self-compassion, although for many of us, that can be one of the hardest ones. So it may be a good place to do a little extra work in, especially if you're the type of person that easily can give compassion to others. Mm. We may need the follow-up, the other compassion journal for narcissists.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. Innately we programmed to have compassion for other people. Yeah.
I really liked, I know I mentioned this in that video I sent you, and I was being honest. I really liked that section on past regrets. So people should go out and get the journal so you can learn from it more. But yeah, that's something I've had to work a lot on, how to be compassionate towards past versions of me that I've outgrown, or I guess you don't necessarily outgrow them. You develop new parts of yourself that take up more space, and, I really liked working through what you had there.
So you're offering me an opportunity to ask you, Thomas, like what is the what is one regret that you worked through with compassion, or what does that look like? You can do a mild one. You don't have to do the worst of the worst. But.
Well, it's always interesting to me because the podcast has grown relatively for a podcast my size, and I can see that a lot of people in my home state listen to this, and it's always interesting to think about who from high school might be listening to this, because I think they would have a hard time integrating the version of me in high school with who I sort of am now. So yeah, I
that's,
think
you're assuming it's the version of them in high school that's integrating the version of you in high school. They've changed.
You just kind of like blew my mind with that. It's true. Wow.
Give them the chance to have changed and grown some wisdom as well. But yes.
No, that's actually that's actually really profound. Yeah, I'm gonna have to sit with that one.
Yeah.
But no, I think just generally I was. And I think part of this is just being young and your brain not being developed and being insecure. But I was just extremely insecure and compensated for that with humor and putting my needs first and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And so I think just younger versions of myself that looking back, I've had so much almost like moral injury around that I've had to really learn how to soften and be kind to myself about and tend to without going into too many details. It's just, I think just kind of like chapters of my younger life have been hard to know how to integrate into my present life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can wall off those chapters of our younger life because we feel embarrassed by them or ashamed of them or.
But something that's helped, I think, is, for a long time, I focused on maybe the ways in which I acted to compensate for some pain and really was judgmental of that. And in the more recent years of my life, I've tended a lot more towards what was underneath all of that. And there's a lot of stuff there that has been important for me to understand what's going on there.
Yeah, that word understanding is so important. In Thich Nhat Hanh's lineage, when they give kids vows, like I take my kids to a retreat with the monastics every year, and they vow to two things. They vow to compassion and understanding. And my son, the other day at school, came home and he said, "You know, Mom, I learned more about this vow of understanding at school," because he goes to this like super socially emotionally advanced school where they talk about things like understanding at a deep level in fifth grade. He's like, "I learned more about the word understanding." And I was like, "Really? Okay, tell me more. I'm curious about this word understanding." And he said, "You know, it also means, if you look at the word, it means to stand under, to support, to stand under, like to understand yourself, to understand another person, to be that sort of bolster of support." And when we go back in time and we think about those younger versions of us that we wish we could just hide away, as a journal entry, like burn that part of it, that chapter. When we actually stand under it and take a look at it, like from underneath, and give it some support, it changes our relationship with it. And if we can change our relationship with something that was our high school self, maybe we can also change our relationship with right now. I mean, even how I'm handling this right now, that is not always perfect. Like Yeah, you see a little tiny bit of how we handle our lives. You don't see what's behind closed door, like the hard days or the hard mornings or the, you know, those pieces. So I think everyone can relate to that. That everyone has their, I guess, shadows, the parts of ourselves that were hard. And those teenage years in particular, those high school years, there is something about, and learning more about, brain development that during those years, because there's so much dopamine and so many neurohormones that are sort of the changes that are happening, you actually remember them more strongly than you do like in your 20s or your 20s. So like these years of our high school years get imprinted in there.
I don't know. That's a whole nother conversation. It's hard to, when there's stuff where maybe you don't have opportunities to repair things that you've done with people. And when they're sort of left out into this like relational limbo state in the cosmos and having to learn how to forgive ourselves when maybe getting forgiveness isn't an option from others.
Yeah. So there's a piece of forgiveness in the journal. And I actually, this is a big one, because I'm sure you see this in therapy. I have a client right now who's had a really conflictual relationship with her mom. And was like, "I'm not going out there. I'm not going out there. I'm not going out there." And then her mom died, you know, and now is in sitting this huge pile of regret. Like, I can't go back and change. I can't go back and have the conversation that maybe I wish that I had with her. Right. And so we have, or maybe the people are still living that we choose not to have conversations with because they're not, it's not helpful to us. They harmed us in some way, or we know it wouldn't be beneficial. And what I really see is that the practice of forgiveness is an internal one, and that we heal, the only place we can heal the past is in the present moment. That is true. The only place we can heal the past. And the only way we shape the future is in the present moment.
Yes.
That's it. So when I have that regret show up, how can I identify it as one connected to a value of mine? You regret because you care. You know, there's a lot of things you don't regret that, you know, like I don't really regret that because it's not linked to a core, you know, a core deep value. So how can I identify that value within myself? And I heal the future by acting on that value in the present moment. And then also, how can I bring some softness, some understanding to the regret, also some contextual understanding to the regret? Because you're looking at your past from the now. You're not looking at your past from the past self, which was going through all the things that your past self was going through, right? This woman who lost her mom has a different understanding now that her mom is gone and is in a different place now. It's a lot safer for her to be able to think about forgiving her mom than it was when her mom was alive. Mm-hmm. So it's a tricky thing, but I do feel that we still, no matter whether the person's in our life or not, or whether we can't go back and do it over, we act on it now. And that's where compassion and self-compassion actually come to fruition in the present.
Wow, that was beautiful. I'm really looking forward to more of your podcast, and it meant a lot to me, a lot of everything that you said, and I'm glad we had this time together.
Thank you, Thomas. Me too. I hope you'll come on. Thank you for being such a supporter. I don't know why. Look, we've barely spent any time together, but we cosmic have this connection.
Yes.
We're spiritual friends. You know, Kalyanamita. You know, like the yes. We have a spiritual cosmic connection.
I feel that too.
Kalyanamitas. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
It's got me out of my mind. It's got me seeing trees breathe. It's got me learning how heaven and hell are both inside of me. It's got me feeling the love that I bottled so deep when the entire world kept feeding on my greed. Try to open myself.